The Sun as the Image of God, Part 1, was presented by Ryan Carroll on March 28, 2010 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2010. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
If you're new to Reformation, I'm not usually one of the teachers. I've been given the opportunity to teach on a passage last week and this week. My name is Ryan Carroll. If you weren't here last week, what I'm going to say this week may or may not be as clear as it could be. I'm going to do a quick overview of what I said, very quick overview of what I said last week. Also, as I went through my notes and was just kind of mentally going through the talk today, I realized that I may not have enough time to do this justice. And David may not know or be aware of this, but I have been told that I could take the week after Easter if I didn't quite get through, so we'll see. But somewhere around 5:30, I'll make a decision. Before we look at the translation that you have now in your hand, just set that aside for a moment, and then I'll talk through it in a bit. Just real quickly, want to remind folks that last week we looked at what's called the Davidic Covenant, and what we got from the Davidic Covenant was that that the title Son of God comes from this covenant that God makes with David. So David is the first son of God, and every king that comes after him in succession is also a son of God, and we looked at a fair length. We looked at what David understood it to mean that he was indeed a son of God, and I'll review that in a moment. But ultimately, my goal is to point out that the titles that are given to Jesus of Nazareth, Messiah, Son of Man, Son of God, these are not unique titles to him. And that's going to be really important going forward to make note of. Now, as Son of God, David's conception was that he was, or he represented physically and symbolically, the rule of God within creation. He was, as the Son of God, the ruler over God's people, Israel. As the Son of God, he was ruler over all the nations, and as the Son of God, he had been given dominion over all creation itself. Okay, and we looked last week at the passages where David is talking about this. So the title and the office of Son was all that happened and was created back in the Old Testament when God instituted the Davidic line. And what I mentioned last week was that ultimately neither David nor Solomon nor any of the kings of Israel that come after truly fulfilled and actualized this role. They didn't ultimately rule with the rule of God, because they were wicked, sinful men. They didn't actually rule over all the nations, nor have dominion over all of creation. And ultimately, what I suggested last week was that in the promise to David that his line of descendants would rule forever, that Jesus, ultimately, when he comes along, he is the Son of God, the unique Son of God that actually fulfills this promise that was made to David by God. You will have a ruler, one of your seeds, ruling forever on your throne. And so when Jesus comes along and the gospel writers and the apostles make a really big deal of Jesus being the son of David, and in fact it's Palm Sunday, the thing that it's important to note, when Jesus comes into Jerusalem before Passover, the people are shouting, "Hosanna to the Son of David." So everyone in Israel, the gospel writers, the apostles, when they're talking about the gospel and when they're making a really big deal about Jesus, it's because he is the fulfillment of this role, this unique role as Son of God. Okay? So, real quickly, just want to kind of, probably being overly explanatory here, but hey, I don't get to be up here very often. So the reason I took so much time going through the Davidic covenant, now that we're looking at Colossians, is to show that there's something really significant about who the Son of God and Messiah is that has nothing to do with whether or not Jesus of Nazareth was a pre-existent being who was the agent of creation and who is both fully man and fully God. But rather, in view of the Davidic covenant, his importance comes from being the Son who embodies the rule of Yahweh physically within creation. As the Son, he symbolically sits on Yahweh's throne, just as David did. And as the Son, he rules over all Israel, not quite yet. And as the Son, he will be granted rule and dominion over all of creation and indeed over all the nations. No one has greater importance within creation than him. God has decided that this man Jesus, who will fulfill and actualize the rule of God over the entire creation, who will represent God to the people of the world, and is the man who is God's unique representative, will be the ultimate litmus test for whether a person is a lover of God or a rebel against him. So indeed, once you understand the Davidic covenant, Jesus becomes quite important apart from being or possibly being pre-existent, an agent of creation, fully God, fully man in his biology. He is important because God has chosen to make it so. Okay, as the fulfiller of this role that he is fulfilling in terms of being the Son of God. Now, that said, Colossians chapter 1, verses 12 through 20, with the traditional translation and interpretation, sure makes it sound like Paul is making quite a big deal about Jesus being pre-existent, Jesus being an agent of creation, and indeed him being the fullness of God. And we'll talk about what that means. So Paul seems to make a big deal out of this. My intention today is to offer what I believe to be a more accurate translation and interpretation of this passage, and to show that it's through the lens of the Davidic covenant that Paul is making these claims about Jesus, and that his claims still very much elevate Jesus as Son, but his claims do so in light of the Davidic covenant, not in light of, for example, the Council of Nicaea. Okay, so I just wanted to make sure that got said. Okay, let's take a look real quickly before I go verse by verse and talk about the decisions I made and the commentary that I have. If you would look at the translation that was handed out to you, you'll see on the left-hand side is the New American Standard version, which I have kind of formatted into what I think is Paul's rhetorical outline for this section. So that's the NASB version. And then the right-hand side, did I say left? Right. Anyway, the right-hand side is my translation and proposed rhetorical outline. So I'm going to read through my translation. You have the NASB there. And if you have any questions about who the hell I am to present this translation to you, I have no answers to that other than other than I've spent a lot of time thinking about this stuff. So, okay. Verse 12, giving thanks to the Father. Again, Paul is he's finishing a prayer here. Giving thanks to the Father who has qualified you by the light to share in the inheritance of the set apart ones, who delivered us out of the rule of darkness and transferred us into the kingdom of the Son of his love, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. Okay, now, what I'm going to propose is that Paul, in what comes after, is going to be making two specific points about who it is that this Son is. Okay? So he's introduced the Son by saying that we have been transferred out of the rule of darkness into his kingdom. Now he wants to talk about what's important about being in the Son's kingdom. Okay? And the two points that he's going to make, what I'm suggesting he's making, I've bolded. The first one is verse 15. This one, the ruler, firstborn over all creation, is the image of the invisible God. Okay, so his first point ultimately is that he's the image of the invisible God, and we'll talk about what else he says there. And then 16, 17, and 18a are an explanation of what he means by he is the image of the invisible God. Okay? Then in 18b through 20, I am suggesting this is Paul's second point, all right? And the point that he's making there is that the Son is the beginning, okay? And then what he has to say about the Son being the beginning is explained in 19 and 20. So that's my proposed outline for how, what I think Paul is doing with this passage. Before I jump in, I need to make just a few brief comments about what the background of the letter itself is. You have the background for the Davidic covenant. Let me just speak to the background of the letter. Most traditional commentaries will tell you that the reason that Paul has written this letter is because he is wanting to write to these new believers in Colossae who he is afraid are going to fall prey to a myriad of religious and Greek philosophical pitfalls in terms of their ultimate believing in the gospel. I don't have time to defend what my counter assertion is, but I'll tell you, and if you have questions afterwards, you can ask me. I'm proposing, and I think it's really clear, that it's not Gnosticism, that it isn't, there's no Greek philosophy that he is concerned about, there's no alternative religious pitfalls that he's concerned about, except one, and that is Judaism. And just like Ephesians, Galatians, Romans, etc., Paul is very much concerned with taking the gospel to the Gentiles and explaining to them that they do not have to become Jewish in their orientation to the Mosaic covenant to receive the blessing of Abraham. So that's my contention about Colossians, is that that is Paul's sole purpose, that he is writing to Gentiles who have fairly recently heard the gospel, had a positive response to the gospel, and he knows, that is Paul, that wherever he's gone and wherever the gospel goes, there also go Jewish detractors, specifically people like the party of the circumcision from Galatians, who are telling Gentiles that it's not enough just to believe in Messiah Jesus. You actually need to be circumcised. You need to make sure you keep Shabbat. You need to take the Mosaic covenant seriously. And so what I'm suggesting is the background for the entire letter is Paul warning his readers of that potential. Okay. Questions about that? Thoughts about that? We can either talk at the end of this week or 2 weeks from now. Okay. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to start working through my translation. I am not going to be able to to speak to every single one of the translational changes that I've made between mine and the NASB text. I'm going to talk about the ones that I think are the most significantly important. And if you have other questions about decisions I've made, please feel free to bring that up in the question and answer time. Okay. All right. So first of all, verse 12, Paul says, giving thanks to the Father who has qualified you by the light to share in the inheritance of the set apart ones. Now, first of all, you'll notice that in the NASB text, the prepositional phrase that I have translated by the light is, I am suggesting that that is what has qualified Paul's readers to share in the inheritance, whereas the NASB text has suggested that the light is a place or a domain for where the saints are. I think I'm not so sure that Paul really cares exactly to suggest where the saints are. I think, given the emphasis on the qualification, I think it's the light that is the qualification that God is giving his readers. So let me talk about that for a second. So first of all, with the background in mind that Paul is speaking to Gentiles who he's concerned are going to be led astray into thinking that they need to become Jews in their orientation to the covenant to inherit the blessing, he is saying, number one, the Father has qualified you. And this is a motif that that comes up over and over and over again, and most specifically, I like the way John in his gospel says it, when he says that you have been made children of God, not by the will of the, not born by blood, nor the will of the flesh, nor the will of man, but by the will of God. And that ultimately, when John is saying these words in chapter one of his gospel, what he has very much in the forefront of his mind is that it's not the physical descendants of Abraham that are going to receive the inheritance. It's not by having a right orientation towards the covenant that you receive the inheritance. Ultimately, God is the one who qualifies you. And that's the really, that's very important. Now, how does he qualify them? He says that he's qualified them by the light. Now, I'm taking the light for a metaphor of some kind of spiritual renewal, sort of eyes to see, that sort of thing. The light is a metaphor for understanding, but what I'm going to suggest is that it's not objective information that is the light, but it is more of subjective inner orientation that the light is. So the light, when I am granted it, leads me to embrace the truth wherever I find the truth, such as the gospel. The light, what I'm suggesting, isn't in itself the gospel, if that makes sense. Also, what is it that the light gets us? Well, he says to share in the inheritance. Now, the inheritance that Paul is talking about, whenever you see this word, I think, in the New Testament, we generally say, oh, the inheritance of the saints, well, that's eternal life, and that's true. But Paul is going, because of what he's doing, it's important for us to know exactly what he means by inheritance. Ultimately, the inheritance of the saints is the blessing of Abraham, okay? Is the blessing of Abraham. Now, as you know, in Genesis, Abraham is promised by God that to be blessed, and that all the nations or all the families of the earth will be blessed in him. Okay, and this promise that God makes to Abraham is given the title the blessing of Abraham. Now, every Jewish man and woman hopes for and considers this blessing theirs by birthright. Okay? Because I am a physical descendant of Abraham, I will stand to inherit Abraham's inheritance, his blessing. All right? Most of Paul's Jewish contemporaries would have believed this. And they would have said that indeed the blessing will go to all the nations, but the nations have to become Jewish in order to get the blessing. Okay? Now, Paul's contention throughout the New Testament and his epistles is that this was false. God is granting this blessing to the peoples of all nations, period. Whether or not they are Jewish in their relationship to the law, the covenant, or not. And as far as getting it by birthright, Paul's response in Romans is not all Israel is descended from Israel. Not all Israel is Israel. That is, not every physical descendant of Abraham stands to inherit his blessing. It is rather those who are of the faith of Abraham. Okay? Through Isaac your descendants shall be named is a theme that Paul echoes. Now, okay, so that's the inheritance. So what exactly I want to talk a little bit more about the inheritance. Why the blessing of Abraham? Well, something that just occurred to me is that there is a very proximal relation between chapter 3 of Genesis and chapter 12 of Genesis, nine chapters. In chapter 3, Adam, who is the father of all nations, is cursed. Okay, he is given a curse. And the curse is something to the effect of that he is going to live a life of futility and then ultimately death will come. So just nine chapters later, God calls out a man from Ur of the Chaldees and says, I don't want to curse you, I want to bless you. And I think that's significant because in so doing, what God is saying is, Abraham, I am going to take you out from among the nations, from out of this curse that you have inherited by being in the descendants and the lineage of Adam. I am going to create a new line from you. Okay? And it's your line that is going to be my people. As Adam decided he didn't want to bear my image and to bow his knee to me, I'm going to create a people from you that will bear my image and will ultimately bow their knee to me. Okay? And what I would suggest is the rest of the Bible is this unfolding of who gets to be in this group of people that is going to not inherit Adam's inheritance of death and futility, but will inherit a new inheritance, one of life and shalom. Now, so also included in that is eternal life in that dignified state that we get to be people who truly love God and bear his image in the sense of being morally good, pure people, and we get to live in that state for eternity. And I think all of that is in mind in terms of the blessing of Abraham. So that's the inheritance. And he says it's the inheritance of, and the NASB translates it, saints. I'm translating it set apart ones. It's more to the root meaning of the word hagios in the Greek. And I think it goes to this idea that what really the saints are really the people who are being set apart from the lineage of Adam to inherit this new inheritance. So I've translated it set apart ones. Okay. Now, verse 13, this father, Yahweh, It's he who delivered us out of the rule of darkness and transferred us into the kingdom of the Son of his love. Now, what I think is important to note here is that verse 13, Paul takes another step. And what he does is he goes one level deeper and he says, ultimately, those who are going to inherit the blessing of Abraham are those who are being defined by being in the kingdom of the Son. Okay? So, in that sense, it's hugely important because what I think Paul is suggesting is that the descendants of Abraham will be truly marked by being open to the Son and being related to the Son. It's the Son who God is going to name, through whom God is going to name his people. So all those who inherit the blessing of Abraham are the same ones who are transferred into the kingdom of the beloved Son, if that makes sense. Now, if I'm right about this, then the rule of darkness that he mentions in verse 13 is our present existence. Now, when I first read, you know, when you first hear this phrase, the rule of darkness, you think, oh, it's Satan's kingdom, and he's got his sharp, pointy hat on, and all that sort of thing, and it's dark and evil. But I think that's the wrong way to take it. I think understanding that this existence, this life, as we are under the curse of Adam, this is the rule of darkness. Darkness, I think, is like light, is a metaphor for ignorance. And that we have been, or those who stand to inherit the blessing of Abraham, have been given the light so that they are no longer ignorant. And they've been, in that sense, transferred out of that ignorance into the kingdom of the Son. Okay. Now, at this point in history, it's important to note that the kingdom of the Son, if by believing in Messiah Jesus, if that is what has transferred me in the light, then it's important to note that at this moment in time, being in the kingdom of the Son is not a truly actualized thing. Yes, we have been given a hope, and yes, we have been granted a perspective of reality that is radically different from what we had prior to being given the light. But that ultimately, eschatologically, it's not until God recreates the heavens and the earth with Jesus physically ruling over them that the reality of that kingdom will be fully actualized. Okay? But for now, we hope, and that's an amazingly incredible thing that Jack talked about in terms of Romans 8, this hope that we've been given. Now, if I'm right about all of this, then Paul's statement that it's in the Son, in verse 14, in whom we have the redemption, the forgiveness of sins, what he means by that is it's just another way to say it's through the Son that we have been brought out of this existence of futility, that we've been brought out of the lineage of Adam, and we are being offered the blessing of Abraham. Okay, and it's those people who find that compelling that ultimately will be forgiven their rebellion. They will have their sins forgiven them. Okay. Now, last thought. You'll notice that that instead of back up in 13, it says that you've been transferred. He's transferred us into the kingdom of the Son of His love. Not beloved son. The construction in the Greek is literally son of his love. I think Paul is doing something unique here, because Paul certainly would have had access to the gospel accounts. It's in the gospel accounts that the word beloved, agapetos, gets used, this is my beloved son in whom I'm well pleased. Well, here it's not beloved. And the thing that makes most sense to me is that that what God ultimately means, or what Paul ultimately means by he is the son of his love, is that in some way, it's through the Son that God is demonstrating and actualizing his love towards mankind. So the Son of his love is a descriptor of part of the what God is doing in the Son. That is, he is proclaiming to all of mankind throughout history his intention to have mercy on us through his Son. I could be wrong about that, but I think it's a significant difference. Okay, now, we have arrived at point one of two, and to leave time for questions and answers, I think I'm only going to be able to do point one, and beg David for one more week. So, I'm going to read through it again, and then we'll go for it. So, this one, the ruler over all creation, is the image of the invisible God. That is, as image of God, all things in the heavens and upon the earth, the visible and invisible things were created for him, that is, for his benefit. Yes, even thrones and dominions, even rulers and authorities. All things were created on the basis of him and for him. And he, as image of God, is above all people, and all people are united in their subjection to him. And he, as image of God, is the ruler or head over the grouping of the ekklesia. And that's the Greek word that always gets translated church. It literally combines the preposition out of with called, the verb to call. So the ekklesia is literally the ones who have been called out. Okay, and we'll talk about, and what I've suggested is it's the same motif as he's talking about up in verse 12. Okay, now, before we jump in, you'll notice that I have made some significant changes between the NASB translation and my own. And I'm hoping to have enough time to talk through the most significant ones. Most notably, you'll notice that in verse 15, I've swapped phrases around. Verse 16, you'll notice that instead of saying all things were created by him, that I've translated it for him. And then in verse 17, instead of continuing on with what the NASB says, and he is before all things, and in him all things hold together, I've translated it, and he is of greater status than all people. So I think he's talking about people there, not things. So, we'll talk through that. Now, first of all, in verse 15, what's important to note is that he makes two statements about the Son. The first one in the NASB translation is that he is the image of the invisible God, and the second one is that he is the firstborn of all creation. Now, I've decided, based on what I think he's doing, that one of these two statements is his main point, and the other statement is simply a way to define again who it is he's talking about. Okay, both the word firstborn and the word image are in the nominative case, and therefore, I've decided that one of them is in apposition to the other as a way to simply further define who he's talking about. Okay, so his main point is that this one, that is the Son, is the ruler over all creation. This one, the Son, the ruler of all creation, is the image of the invisible God. Okay. Now, I'm going to talk about what image of invisible God is in a moment, but I just want to make a quick pass at why I have taken firstborn and translated it ruler instead of kept it at firstborn. First of all, traditional theology generally tends to use this verse. I don't exactly know how they do it, but the idea is that that he's firstborn of all creation, and somehow from that they come up with that he's the first being that was ever around. Okay. Now, firstborn obviously has connotations of birth and that sort of thing and creation. So how traditional theology gets past Jesus being a pre-existent eternal from the beginning of time to him being a firstborn person, I'm not quite sure. But what I mentioned last week was, if you'll remember in Psalm 89, David's talking about the covenant that God makes with him. And in referencing the covenant, David says that God had said that I will make David my firstborn, the highest of all the kings of the earth. Now, David says that God says about him that he is God's firstborn. And what I had mentioned last week was that this is not a literal term. This is a metaphorical term for, that I am suggesting is a title. So when Paul uses it here, it's a loaded title, messianic title. And that it literally refers to, in Jewish society, firstborns were all the deal because, if you go back and look at the covenant, the Mosaic covenant, they make a really big deal out of the firstborn child getting the inheritance of the father, a greater portion of the inheritance, getting to be sort of the executor of all the father's things, that sort of thing. So when God says of David, he's my firstborn, thinking about the Davidic covenant, that is this metaphorical idea that David, as my representative, is literally the one who stands to inherit all of what is mine. Okay? Now, we know that, so in that sense, he gets dominion over creation, he gets dominion over the people of God, etc. So, and, you know, it's obvious that God could not have possibly meant that he had relations with David's mother when he calls David his firstborn. It is very much a title. Now, as when we apply the title to Jesus, who actually fulfills the Davidic covenant, to understand that it has the loaded connotation that he literally is ruler, inheritor over all of God's creation. Okay? Now, so I've translated it ruler over all creation, not just of creation. If you want to check me on that, there's a, in John chapter 17, verses 1 and 2, Jesus is praying to God, and he says something about that thou hast given the Son of Man authority over all creation. And there, in that particular place, the Greek syntax is exactly the same as it is here. It would make no sense to translate it, you have given the Son of Man authority of all creation. I think the idea is that it is very much over creation. So that's why I've made that decision there. Okay. So, now, if this one, that is the ruler over all creation, Paul's point is that he is the image of the invisible God. Now, before we can figure out what that means, we need to figure out what being the image of the invisible God, sort of what's entailed there. Paul makes the point of describing God as invisible. Why does he do this? I think Paul is referring to God's transcendent otherness. God is not a seeable, touchable entity, all right? As creator, he is not a part of his own creation. He is very much outside of his own creation. That is, he is transcendent. Now, this concept is important because it's this concept of the transcendence of God that makes the Davidic covenant meaningful. God desires to have his rule, authority, and knowable character vested and embodied within creation in a human being. Okay? And that human being is Jesus of Nazareth. So, to be the image of the invisible God, that is, Jesus as image of God, is to be very much the fulfiller of the Davidic covenant. He is the physical, seeable, tangible representation of the God who is invisible. He, the Son, uniquely and visibly bears the image of God, bears the character of God, bears the authority of God, the role of God, in a seeable, knowable way. Therefore, it follows that as the unique human being who bears his identity, that all of created reality, creation, history, all of life itself, is subject to him, the unique son of David. Okay, so that's what I think he has in mind when he says image of God. Now, you'll notice that 16, 17, and 18a, I'm suggesting, are sort of an explanation of this. And you'll notice that verse 16, as image of God, all things, Paul says, in the heavens and upon the earth, the visible and the invisible things were created for him. Yes, even thrones and dominions, even rulers and authorities. All things were created on the basis of him and for him. Now, so I think that's ultimately his statement of the dominion that is given to the one who bears the image of God. Now, in light of the Davidic covenant, I think given that it was the Son of God, that is the Son of David, who was going to inherit God's creation, that was going to rule over his people, it just makes a ton more sense to me to translate that all of creation was made for him, that is, for the one who is the firstborn who stands to inherit all of this stuff, rather than to say that it was made by him. Now, I could be wrong, but I think I'm right. Now, so let's talk real quickly about how I get to decide that it's the word is for rather than by. In Greek, as you of all who've listened to any of the teachers here for any amount of time know that that this particular word, for and by, these are prepositions, and the Greek preposition used here is the Greek preposition en, epsilon nu. And as I'm sure you all have remember being told, that lots of times Greek prepositions are just so flexible. If you go into any given lexicon, under the entry for this Greek preposition, you will find literally 24 different uses different uses or meanings for this one word, this one preposition. I have a list here somewhere. These uses include in, on, at, among, because of, on account of, in the presence of, for, by, to, toward, etc., etc., etc. So, ultimately, just looking at the word, you don't know whether Paul meant for or by or anything else. What you're left with is solely context to give you to make your decision for you. So what I'm suggesting is that the context in light of the Davidic covenant just makes so much more sense to say, to leave God as creator and to leave Jesus as the fulfiller of the Davidic covenant in that he is inheriting all of God's creation. All things were created for him. Stone me later if you want. I think, given the time, I'm going to suggest the same thing about the last sentence in verse 16. All things were created dia him, that is, on the basis of him. Again, another preposition. I'm not going to defend that. Jack has done a lot of work on dia. I could give you some verses that I think make a whole lot more sense to understand it as on the basis of rather than through or by, which it usually is translated. Now, so what? So as image, all things are going to be put under his feet. He is granted the dominion over all creation. He is granted dominion over all the nations. He is the seeable, knowable translation of who God is, and he is unique in that way. Now, also, Paul says, as image, verse 17, he is above all people, and all people are united in their subjection to him. Now, so I've made the translation decision that instead of translating, continuing the translation that all things were put in subjection to him, and I think the NASB says he is before all things and in him all things hold together. I think traditional theology takes that sentiment that he is before all things to mean, again, that he as the Son of God was way back before anything else was created. And in him all things hold together. I think the idea somehow is that he's some kind of cosmic glue that without him everything kind of disintegrates and falls apart. That could be what he's saying. Again, through the lens of the Davidic covenant, I think that what we have to ask ourselves is, okay, if verse 16 is that he is over all of creation and that every single cotton-picking thing that exists for him, for his benefit, then does it make sense to continue to say, and all things, he is before all things? My contention is that it doesn't make sense to say that. Now, you'll note that, first of all, the word that gets translated all things in the Greek is the adjective pos. And there is no word thing there. There's no people there. It's just the neuter plural form of this adjective that just means all. Okay. Now, in Greek, adjectives can be used as substantive nouns. Okay. So when we have a plural adjective that has no seeming noun that it goes with, then you need to make a decision. What noun is he describing? What all is there? What all is in view? Now, the translators of the NASB have continued the idea down from verse 16. It's all things. Well, again, you have to decide this based on the context. Now, if the last verse is all about how all things were created for the Son, does it make sense that Paul would be redundant and suggest that he, as the image, is of greater status than all things? Not likely. That sentiment would obviously follow from the original statement that all things were created for him. So, if Paul is not saying that he is of greater status than all things, what other all might it be that as the image of God, that he would be greater than? The only thing that makes sense to me is that he would have greater status than all people. Before you blame me for playing fast and loose with the language, I just want to point out that a couple of other things. First of all, if you go down into verse 20 of the NASB text, it says, "And through him to reconcile all things to himself, having made peace through the blood of his cross." Well, things don't need reconciliation. It's people that need to be reconciled. So I would make the case there that the context very much would require me to make the decision that it's people that are in view down in verse 20. Again, like I've said, 16, when he says all things were created for him, he seems to kind of cover that. So what I'm going to suggest is that that starting in 17, when he uses that Greek adjective pos, he is referring to people. If you want to sort of check up on that, there is a verse in Colossians chapter 3, verse 11, where Paul says, "There is neither Jew nor Gentile, there is neither circumcised nor uncircumcised, there is neither barbarian nor Scythian, but Christ is in all and is all." Well, again, there is a place where the neuter plural form of that Greek adjective all has to be referring to all people, given the context there. And so what I'm going to suggest is that as the image of God, then, that he is over all of creation, and as the image of God, he has a greater status than all people. Okay? And all people are united in him. Now, the word "in their subjection" is not in the text, but if people are united in him, the question that I would have is, in what other way would it make sense that people are united in the Son? And I think it only makes sense in light of the Davidic covenant that they are going to ultimately be united in their subjection to him. Okay. Now, the last verse 18a, "He is the image of God as the ruler, head over the grouping, the body of the ecclesia." Again, as image, if he represents God within creation visibly, then it stands to reason that he is going to be the ruler or the head over the group of people that God is blessing with the blessing of Abraham. Okay, so I think that's what he has in mind there. The word church, ecclesia, is those who have been called out of the darkness to be granted this blessing. So he is the image of God, is the ruler over that group of people as well. So he's the ruler over all creation. He is the, as image of God, he is the ruler over all people. And as the image of God, he is going to be the ruler over the group of people who stand to receive the blessing of Abraham. Now, we don't have time for me to go on to point two. Point two is a lot of fun. Hope you come back in a couple weeks. So I'm gonna open it up for questions. Before I do, though, I forgot to mention that what I'm suggesting is that these two points, after he introduces the idea of being transferred out of the darkness into the kingdom of the beloved Son, Paul knows that he has to make the case to his Gentile readers that the Son is a really, really, really important person. And ultimately, he's the most important being who has ever existed. And so to be in the Son, to be in the kingdom of the Son, is just heads and tails more important than to be oriented rightly to the Mosaic covenant, to be circumcised, because what he will say later in Colossians is that if you are in the Son, you have a completeness, because as the image of God, he is the very touchstone. He is the very litmus test that what you do with him, how you deal with him, is what you do with God. And so to be the image of God is also for him to be the ultimate, to be that ultimate litmus test in terms of defining and naming who the people will be that will stand to inherit this blessing. Okay, I've been a little unclear at points. Questions, if you have any.
So the word firstborn.
Yeah.
It seems in the New Testament that mm-hmm. the authors are there are like two things that they're trying to deal with. I mean, there's a lot of things, but there's two things that they're trying to deal with, namely, like, okay, so why does it matter that we had like the Old Testament,
mm-hmm.
and then they have to be like, and like, what is the significance that Jesus like rose from the dead and like all the sort of New Testament stuff?
I mean, right.
It's not. So there's like these new. What is the significance of all this stuff that God did with Jesus? Here in verse 18, the NASB translates it mm-hmm. as he is the firstborn from the dead.
Mm-hmm.
And then, if I recall, I think in Romans, it also uses the language firstborn from the dead. And it also uses...
I think it says firstborn among many brethren or something like that. But yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then in Revelation, it also has like firstborn from the dead. Mm-hmm. So it would seem, or at least it's been, I have heard it been interpreted that when it has firstborn from the dead, it is sort of this... Jesus' resurrection is a manifestation of like what God can do to the set apart ones.
Okay.
Is that not at all in view? Is he just using firstborn there differently, or is that there, or how are you seeing that?
Well, I didn't have a chance to touch on that this week. I'm going to talk a lot about that in a couple weeks. It's just going to take too much time to go through all the decisions that led me to see both the verse 15 firstborn and the verse 18 firstborn as titles, not describing arising from the dead in verse 18b, like you mentioned. So. I've thought a lot about that. I, in wrestling with this passage over the last 2 years, I've had to kind of come to grips with and try to think about and decide, is firstborn being connected with the actual raising from the dead or not? And in 2 weeks, I'll be able to explain myself more, but you're right in questioning that, and maybe I'll reserve the right to not answer totally right now.
Great.
Okay.
It seems like there are several places in Scripture that we see this idea that existing before something else gives you a greater authority. In one of the epistles, I can't remember which one it is, it talks about how Adam was held accountable for Eve's sin, or there was something about the idea seems to be that because Adam was created first, that's the basis of his authority, mm-hmm. and we see evidence of this because God held him accountable even though it was Eve who sinned. And when John the Baptist says, I tried to find it. I can find it, but he says something like, "The one who comes after me is higher than me because he existed before me." Mm-hmm. But John the Baptist was actually born like 6 months before Jesus mm-hmm. was. So there seems to be some sense in which, and Jesus is referred to as the lamb slain before the foundation of the earth. So there seems to be some sense in which Jesus' authority derives from his, in some sense, existing before everything else. And it's interesting that so much of traditional theology wants to talk about the pre-incarnate Christ and that kind of thing to try to make sense of that when nobody's saying that this pre-incarnate Christ was actually killed before the foundation of the earth.
Well, I think actually some people out there in the radio land have heard
saying that. Okay. Yeah. Well, what I was thinking was if Jesus was the reason for everything being created, uh-huh. there's a sense in which logically he existed in the mind of God mm-hmm. before anything else. And God intended to, in order to create something for someone, you have to think of that someone first. You know, even if you
right.
that person isn't physically around,
mm-hmm.
and God's intent is the connection between what God intends to do and what actually happens is so strong that you could actually say Jesus existed before everything else because that connection, you know, God speaks it, it happens, and before he speaks it, he must conceive it in his mind. So I'm thinking that maybe I like what you say about the firstborn being an indication of God's of Jesus' authority, God making him the King of Kings. But I'm wondering if the way we ought to know that, because it's not Jesus' imageness, because we're in the image of God when he's, you know, let us create man in our image, and the Hebrew word that's used there is the same word that's used when it talks about Adam begetting his sons. You know, they were created in his image. It's the same thing. And we are also in the image of God. So possibly the way God signals his intent to give Jesus the authority that he does is that He is the one that creation was made for.
Mm-hmm.
Because of him, everything was created. On behalf of him, everything was created.
Mm-hmm.
He existed in God's mind before anything else, and God intended to slay him, which means, in effect, he was slain before the beginning, before the foundation of the earth. That's whatever logic makes sense of the lamb being slain before the foundation of the earth also makes sense of Jesus existing, because how can he be slain if he didn't exist? Existing beforehand, and this logic of Adam had authority over Eve because he came first, and Jesus had authority, had a higher rank than John the Baptist, even though John the Baptist technically was born 6 months earlier than Jesus was, because he has preeminence in the mind of God. It was the very first thing, when God thought about what he was going to do, the very first thing he thought about is Jesus. This is all going to be for Jesus. Does that sound, make any sense at all?
No, thank you, Margaret. I hope that what is construed by what I've said today, I don't disagree with, and I don't think my translation disagrees with anything you've just said, that indeed in the mind of God, the Son, that is Jesus, was the basis and the foundation for which he was going to tell his story and to do everything that he does and to create what he creates. So I would suggest that that doesn't mean that Jesus had to physically exist in some, as a man, in some transcendent other place before the foundation of the earth, but just that that indeed this was God's plan, and that he was going to enact that out. So I think that I agree with everything you just said.
Hey, Ryan. That was really good. That was really persuasive. So thank you. I just had a question about 17. You kind of talked about pos, the all thing. And I don't have the Greek here. Is the thing that typically gets translated all things there, that you're translating all people, is that just the nominative plural of pos, or is it ta upon ta? Mostly I'm wondering, is it ta upon ta and you're translating it all peoples, or is it a different?
I should know this. You got it? Yeah. I've lost it. Yeah, so in that particular case, I don't remember what. I'm assuming it's in the nominative case, but yeah, in all places where you find it, it's in this passage, it's in the neuter, and it's plural.
Okay, and that's why you brought up the example of neither man nor woman. Yeah, that whole thing, and then he finishes all or all. And,
yeah.
And you're saying that's also ta, pon ta.
Exactly.
So that, okay.
Yeah.
I got it. Okay, that's all. Thanks.
Yeah, and there are actually a few places in Ephesians that I'm going to touch on in a couple weeks that, again, the same thing is happening. It's the neuter plural form of pos, and it gets translated things, but it just is so obvious that Paul is he has people in mind when he's talking there, and I think just a much clearer understanding of the passage is to render it people. So,
thanks.
Yep. I don't know. Do we have time for one more? Maybe not. No, we don't have time for one more. Do we have time? All right. You can come back in 2 weeks. Thank you very much.